A most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Afternoon Satsang. As always, joining you from our studios at Prashanthi Nilam, this is Prem from Team Radio Sai, and with me is Arvind. And we are here to continue a topic that we started not just last Thursday, in fact, we should say last Wednesday, because those of you who had the opportunity to catch the programs that were happening in the Mandir as part of the birthday celebrations, on the 20th of November, the Wednesday evening, we had a presentation on Swami's Vahinis, which was a precursor to a program that the organization was going to take up in war footing, literally, which is referred to as Sri Satya Sai Vahini Swadhyaya, where they would take up the study of the Vahinis in a very systematic manner, starting from the Samiti level to the district level, going on to the state and the national level. And this was a program which was meant to explain and make it available to people as to what amount of effort and love went into the writing of the Vahinis. And a few of us had the opportunity to be a part of it from Radio Sai. And a lot of things which we wanted to say that evening which could not be covered, and there was so much of it which is so important to all of us, we decided to share some of that in the afternoon satsang that we had last week. And we realized that it was not enough to complete whatever we had to say, so we are having it as an extension even to this week. So we're going to continue in that discussion about Swami's Vahinis. It just gives us another glimpse into Swami's divinity and Swami's effort into trying to make us lead a spiritual life, and that is what it is. And I think whether we study the Vahinis or not, we hope that all of us do take it up seriously. I think that revelation of what the Vahinis are to give is for each one to discover. But to know about what it contains or what amount of effort went into it is Bhagavatam itself. It is very much part of Swami's life, because Swami wrote it for 26 long years. As it was mentioned on that day, it probably is a world record of sorts. No single author has probably contributed to one magazine month after month for so many years continuously. So it becomes a part of Swami's Bhagavatam itself, because it, as we're going to see today, It was intertwined with the various things that Swami did through his avataric sojan. So before we go into all that, let's invite Arvind to join all of us. Sai Ram, Arvind.
Sai Ram, Prem, and Sai Ram to all our listeners. Very interestingly, we come across a discourse in which Swami says that gifts that you get unasked are more valuable than the gifts you ask and you get. If we think about this, we realize that it contains very, very important lessons for us in life. Swami says that I give you what you seek so that one day you seek what I have come to give. So when we seek and when we receive, we are doing it on the basis of what we think is good for us. And life's experiences have taught us to different extents that most of the times what we think is good for us doesn't turn out to be good for us. That is where the concept of surrender comes in, where we take whatever happening to us as good for us, because we know that Swami is in charge and Swami knows what is best for us. So when we are steeped in that surrender, it becomes very natural for us to just accept whatever Swami gives, because we know that that is the best for us. And therefore, it's very easy to understand now why what we receive without seeking, this is particularly with respect to God, I'm saying, not with respect to the world or any worldly relationships. With respect to God, what we receive from God without seeking is definitely much, much more valuable than what we receive from God after we seek. Because what we seek is what is good for us in our opinion. But what God gives is what is good for us truly. I'm just reminded of a little story of how there was this little boy who was always well behaved, very patient. Especially on Children's Day, there used to be a shopkeeper who would gift all the children with chocolates. And therefore, on that Children's Day, all the children would rush to this person's shop to grab as many chocolates as they could. And what the shopkeeper would do is open up the chocolate box and show it to each child as he or she comes and tell them to pick as many as they want. And every child would put in the hand into the box and try to pick as many chocolates as possible, except for this boy of ours. This little boy would always wait patiently, and in the end he would go and he would not grab at the chocolates. He would tell the shopkeeper, "You give me. I will take whatever you give." And the shopkeeper would say, "No, no, you take." He would say, "No, no, you give. Whatever you give only, I'll take." And then the shopkeeper would put his hand and give chocolates. This boy would hold out his t-shirt, reverentially receive the chocolates, bundle them up in the t-shirt and go home. Later, the boy says that, you know, if I put my hand and take chocolates, my hand is very small. I may be able to grab at best 5 or 6 chocolates. But when the shopkeeper gives me, his hand is so big, so definitely 10 to 15 chocolates I get. So though I don't grab, though I don't rush, every Children's Day I end up with the maximum number of chocolates. Very, very intelligent boy indeed. And that is the case with us asking and grabbing from God versus holding out our hands and saying, "Lord, you give whatever you please." The Lord's hands are always bigger than ours, and therefore what he decides to give to us spontaneously on his own definitely is of much, much greater value than what we decide to grab. Now, before going further on this, maybe we can play that little poem that Swami would often sing in between his discourses to amplify the same sentiment.
Adugakuve o manasa, adugakuve o manasa.
Oh mind, don't desire, don't ask.
Adugukoladi adi, aduguna badungani, adugakuna pani, vadigana gunani, adugakuve o manasa.
If you ask more and more, it will be neglected. Without asking, it shall be granted and given. Without asking, sabari has been given.
So that was the Padya which Arvind was referring to. We've heard this many, many times. And as you rightly said, it is born out of that wisdom that what I want and what I know, what I understand is much lesser than what he understands and he can give. And Swami would often say that, you know, even when we were talking about the Vahinis, we were saying this. One is the smartness of the devotee to not ask and to believe in the omniscience of the Lord. And the other thing is the aspect of love itself, right? Many times when you love the person, you love everything that that person gives and you're ready to accommodate everything that that person gives and embrace whatever that person gives. And even in that sense, you know, in many ways, Swami would give us that opportunity to wait to see what Swami wants, right? Even if we were to, you know, happen to invite Swami to your hostel or invite Swami to your home, that's what we would often think, right? I often remember this. The first time, I think when I was in UG or sometime when Swami came to the hostel, I don't exactly remember when. I think it was during the summer course or something. And the menu was very simple. You know, you usually think that when Swami comes, the menu should be really grand and, you know, we have some items which we think are grand. But that day, the menu was actually quite simple, even in hostel standards. I think there was some beans curry and there was some tamarind rice and some papad and all of that. And I asked one of the students, you know, why didn't they make something special when Swami came? Apparently, some of those dishes were the dishes that Swami would tell the cooks whenever he would visit the hostel.
Mm-hmm.
In the earlier years, when Swami would come, they would go and ask Swami, "Swami, what should we make for lunch when Swami comes?" And Swami would name some of these items. He would say, "Make a beans curry, make lemon rice, and let there be papad, and there should be paisam." So in a way, it was like, this is what Swami likes when he comes. In our mind, there might be something else which we think is grand and, you know, which
pizza and
right. Or at least the paneer curries and all those rich items. But when the moment you say that Swami is coming, you know that we have to do what Swami likes, right? And it is not even out of the idea that then Swami will be pleased and then Swami will give me something or bless us. It is not even that. It's just an expression of love. When you love somebody, you try to do what that person likes and what that person expects. So even in that sense, if there is something that Swami, in a sense, you can say this was like a unexpressed desire of Swami when Swami gave the Vahinis. When we were preparing for this program, I was telling one of the brothers, never once we have heard Swami making a reference to the Vahinis himself. If you read some of the other spiritual masters, and I don't want to take any names, there's one particular spiritual master, very, very well read, and his discourses used to be phenomenal, his writings used to be phenomenal. If you read some of his interactions with devotees, when devotees would ask questions and he would give explanations, he would give a brief explanation and he'll say, I've written about this in this particular book, go and read there. Right? Constantly you would make that. And there's another spiritual master there's a very famous quote which says, you know, if you love me, distribute my books. We have not heard Swami saying anything like this. He has given the greatest of gift, but he has left it at your discrimination to say, this is how I want to express my love to Swami, because this was an unasked gift and this is an unspoken opportunity. Swami never said, do this for me. And in that sense, if you look at it, it's really a blessing in that the Vahinis are.
As that poem that Swami said goes, wasn't Shabari given the greatest without her asking? Didn't the bird Jatayu, who died for him, get the ultimate without asking? That is the thing. You know, when Jatayu, we know Jatayu, how the bird goes and fights against Ravana when Ravana is kidnapping Sita. And in the process, his wings get cut and he's on his deathbed. He didn't have any expectation of Rama. He didn't expect that, Rama, I've done this for you, so you should do this for me. Even, you see, the beautiful thing about Jatayu is, having done so much, it had no expectation. I'm saying it, but we should actually say he, because it's such a, because Jatayu is such a noble being. He had no expectations from Rama even after having done so much. When I look back at my own life, every little sacrifice, what I have perceived as sacrifice I have done, I come up with the expectation that Swami will bless me. And most of the time Swami has actually blessed. I remember in class 11, when I was in class 11, or was it class 12, 98, 99, one of those years, there was an eye camp done by the alumni of the Satsang Institute of High Learning at Kottacheruvu.
Okay.
And because it was all cataract surgeries, all the patients who had been operated, they had to be kept under observation for 2 nights, so that they don't, you know, it was not laser surgery those days. So there would be a physical cut on the eye when the cataract surgery has been done. So for almost 48 hours, the patient shouldn't rub their eyes. So the eye patch will be there, but still somebody had to sit with them through the night to ensure that in their sleep also they should not rub. And many of these patients were so poor that they didn't have family members, or there were nobody there. So they asked, are there anybody ready to volunteer? It was the vacation time, winter vacation. And I felt, let me go and volunteer my time. This is a great seva. Winter vacation, less boys are there. And if I do seva, surely Swami will give me some nice chance. So I had volunteered for 2 nights. It was tiring, but basically just watch over them whole night. And if they want to go to the restroom or, you know, toilets, take them, help them. Many of them were old people. So did it for 2 nights. And sure enough, 3 days later, actually, I got a very beautiful opportunity where Swami wanted to gift a group with group photographs.
Mm-hmm.
And he picked me up out of the blue. Like, in the physical sense, I wasn't a form boy or anything like that. But I got the opportunity to go actually click those photographs. And the teachers in the hostel made multiple copies, as many copies as the number of people in the photograph, bundled it up and gave it to me to offer it to Swami. Swami accepted the offering, blessed me, gave Pad Namaskar. So I was so thrilled. And many times, I'm sure if we look back, whenever we have done anything for Swami, Swami has rewarded us, we feel thrilled. What I'm trying to say is, for little things, like keeping awake 2 nights, I expect Swami to come and give me some reward. And Jatayu didn't do that also. Jatayu has given up his life now. He's about to die. And yet, when Rama came, he didn't tell anything. He just said, Rama, that demon has carried your wife away in this direction. He told only those things which he felt will be useful for Rama. What devotion it is, what love it is. And therefore, Rama gives Jatayu the privilege that people say that even Dasharatha, his own father, did not get. Wherein Rama performs all the funeral rites and promises Jatayu that you have no more birth now. You know, usually they say that the pinnacle of evolution is a human birth. after which alone you can get liberated. But Jatayu was a bird, an eagle or vulture, I don't know. It was a bird that got liberated. And so, it is very clear that what the Lord spontaneously gives is grander and greater than what we can ever imagine. And that is why, as you rightly said, the Vahinis become very special, because we might not have realized it, but and Swami might not have advertised or marketed it, but it was something that he spontaneously gifted and put his life into, as we shall see ahead in the satsang. He spent hours, weeks, months, years in this labor of love, and that is why, you know, it is something very, very valuable. Just like what Jatayu got is invaluable, it is the ultimate gift. This is on par with that. This is the ultimate gift. This is an awesome, mind-blowing gift which we have not realized, neither has Swami advertised. It will be for our own good if we are able to realize it, understand that this is a gift of spontaneity, cherish it, and start trying to absorb that into our own lives.
You know, when you talk about Jatayu and we're talking about Vahinis, the beautiful thing about the Vahinis, especially the Ramkatha and the Bhagavatam, is the very beautiful lessons that Swami has put in all of them. You know, those are lessons for all of us. Talking about Jatayu's selfless, he never asked. In the Vahini, Swami actually explains that Jatayu's birds, the wings are cut off and he falls down. And Swami says that, you know, the bird which has lost its wings, it bleeds to death. And Jatayu realizes that if it bleeds to death, it will not be able to serve Rama anymore. Rama will come there and he'll just see, he will not know what has happened. So Swami says that Jatayu rolls in the dust so that the mud will clog the, you know, pore so that it doesn't bleed. So it can live a little more so that it can do a little more seva to Rama.
Wow.
So Swami would say, and the comparison is that of, you know, somebody like Maricha. Maricha also is having the wisdom to understand that it is better to die at the hands of Rama instead of dying at the hands of Ravana. So he has the intelligence, but imagine if he was really a person who wanted to serve, probably at that time, instead of calling Rama and Lakshmana, he would have said that, Rama, don't come here, or Lakshmana, don't come here, you know, this is a trap to catch you, or something like that. You know, that is the difference between somebody who is ready to serve selflessly. And I think these are the kind of insights which Swami puts in all the Vahinis. And Swami says, what is given unasked is the highest. And to, you know, literally reverse that, we are looking for what is that thing which Swami gave unasked. Let's go after that. And in that list, probably top is the Vahinis which Swami has given.
In that presentation, I remember we had a brief segment where we tried to find the similarities and differences between the Vahinis and discourses. I think this can figure as one more difference, because possibly there are many discourses which we have asked for from Swami. You know, I literally remember multiple occasions where Swami says, no, I don't want to speak. And we say, Swami, please, Swami, Swami, please speak to us, Swami. Swami, this is the occasion. Please come to hostel, speak to us, Swami. And as we go back into the older Satisai speaks, say, I'm talking of the 1960s, we realize that people from Bukkapattam have called Swami to a temple saying that, Swami, we have got electrified lights now in our temple. Please come inaugurate and talk to us. So, discourses Swami has given on many occasions, spontaneously definitely, but on many occasions he has given because he has been asked to give. He has been requested.
There was one discourse which we came across recently, right, where Swami was giving a discourse because the stage was taking time to get ready.
Oh.
There's a discourse like that where Swami is saying that, you know, I'm speaking now because the organizers asked me to speak till the stage
My
gets
God,
ready.
As a kind of time filler.
Right.
So, there have been occasions like that, but Vahinis, one can rest assured that it's not been like that. Nobody has even asked Swami. I think right from naming the Sanatana Sarathi to starting it in 1958, all of them were absolutely, even in a worldly sense, completely Swami's decision. Of course, everything that the avatar does is the avatar's decision. But in the worldly sense, many decisions look like they have been prompted by the instruments or, you know, it has been completely someone else's idea, apparently, in the physical worldly sense, I'm saying. But the Vahinis, even in a physical worldly sense, have been spontaneous, and even a person like Professor Kasturi, who was the all-in-all for the Prashantinilayam ashram. He was the postmaster, he was the translator, he was the secretary of the ashram, maybe. He was everything. He was doing everything. Even he had no clue when Swami said that we will be doing this. So he was the first person to get to know that the Sanatana Sarathi would start, and we heard how the name itself Swami came out with, and what will be the content of that magazine, you know. Swami saying that we'll start this magazine, but what will be the content? Swami said, I will write. And if we see the history, we realize that Swami was so passionate. It was definitely a Vahini. Vahini means a ceaseless, powerful flow. It was that, because even as it began in February 1958, during the Shivratri, Swami started writing articles not just under one theme, but under two themes. One set of articles have now been compiled into what we know as the Prema Vahini, that is the first Vahini, and the other set of articles have been compiled into what we know today as the Sandeha Nivarini. For 25 months, Swami wrote the Prema Vahini. For 21 months, Swami wrote the Sandeha Nivarini. Interestingly, 21 months, Swami was writing both. The Sanatana Sarathi would begin with the Prema Vahini and conclude with the Sandeha Nivarini.
Right, and you know, when you look at Swami's life, Satyam Shivam Sundaram, we know that 1958 and 59, Swami was traveling extensively. I think 1957, 58 was the first time Swami went
North
to
India.
Rishikesh. Mm. Swami visited Shivananda Ashram. And Swami was touring a lot in even in Venkatgiri and all these places. I think many of these were precursors to what we spoke of as the Vedapurusha Saptavijnani Yajna in the 60s. These are all places that Swami was touring. East Godavari, the West Godavari district. And all this was written through that travel, through that. And you know, not only Swami was busy when travel, I mean, all the festivals when Swami was in Prashantinilayam also, he was extremely busy, as we have seen some of the letters that Swami would write. Swami would say, there's no time at all. And Swami would say, this is 4 o'clock in the morning or 11 in the night, and I'm sitting in the bathroom and writing this letter. And many of the Vahinis also were written like that, you know, under the torchlight, because Swami cannot switch on the light in his room, so that, you know, otherwise the devotees who are sleeping under the trees around will get alerted, and they will, you know, expect Swami to come out.
That is another reason why they are called the Vahini, I feel. Because just imagine, all of us get our moments of inspiration and creativity. But in order to trigger that, we often need some settings. You know, a calm place, possibly not too hot, not too cold. You're comfortable, you're not hungry, you're well rested. These are not necessary conditions for inspiration, but in these conditions, usually your inspiration can express itself well. You know, I find myself, if I want to write something which is very creative and nice, all these help. I mean, if you tell me that when you're traveling from Puttaparthi to Bangalore in a bus, can you write an article on the Vedapurusha Yajna? It may not flow so freely. That is for normal humans like us. But the conditions in which Swami has written these, and when you read them, the wisdom that they contain, it shows that for Swami, it was more like putting on and putting off the tap. There is no need to wait for the springs of inspiration to, you know, burst forth, and whenever they burst forth, it has to be written. It's not like that. It's already there. Everything is there. It's about Swami finding some time to pen them, because as we heard during the Vahini Satsang, there was that occasion where Swami told Professor Kasturi to wait, walked into a room, and in 40 minutes wrote on the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. This is when the Upanishad Vahini was being written. He wrote the complete thing furiously, without a single scratch, without any error, and just gave it. So it's beautiful to think of it, that it's a literal Vahini. It's just about opening the dam gates and it flows, because there is no need to wait for inspiration, process it, correct it, find the correct words, nothing. It's just a flow, and that is the reason I think, whether it's 4 a.m. or whether it's Parthi or Rishikesh or Badrinath, wherever it is, the flow just had to find time and it would be there.
And in fact, even as you were saying that for a brief time, Swami was writing two Vahinis. If you look at the timeline, actually Swami was writing three in the beginning. Because from January 1959, Swami started Dhyana Vahini, when already Prema Vahini and Sandeha Nivarini were in progress.
Correct.
So for a few months, Swami actually wrote three articles for each edition of Sanatana Sarathi.
Wow.
So for 26 months, from January 1959 to February 1960, Swami wrote about the Dhyanavahini, which is the exposition on meditation, which Swami had written, and I think it's a very, very beautiful work. In fact, it's central to the idea of meditation when we speak about Swami. Maybe we'll just take a short break, dear listeners. We'll come back. We will briefly go through the timeline of the various Vahinis, because as we said, this is Bhagavatam. This is very much a part of Swami's avataric sojan. So we'll take a short break, and after that we'll come back into these Vahinis.
Altyazı M.K.
Welcome back, dear listeners. That song that you just heard was the song which was performed that day as part of the presentation. And the most interesting thing about the song is that it has been written by Swami himself. It was written about the Vahinis. And very beautifully, Swami summarizes what each Vahini is about. And the very first line of that song is a revelation of what the Vahinis are meant to give. It is supposed to reveal the source of Ananda within. Coming back to what we were talking about, we were going through the list of Vahinis and the different timelines. And as we just mentioned, for about a year or so in the beginning, 1959, Swami wrote three Vahinis simultaneously, Prema Vahini, Sandeha Nivarani, and Dhyana Vahini. And Dhyana Vahini is something which is, one thing which what you feel when you read Dhyana Vahini is, it is about meditation, and most often meditation has different techniques of meditation, other Kundalini Yoga, Hatha Yoga, Vipassana, and all of these. Swami's meditation was very, very simple, what he taught about. If there was any technique that Swami spoke about, it was only Jyoti meditation. But other than that, whatever Swami spoke of in meditation was to take a form and name of your liking, which you have love towards, and then concentrate on that, contemplate on that form. And Swami would always speak of that. And the thing is, this was written way back in 1959. And the very same techniques were taught by Swami to Swami students 3 decades later, or much later, when we all came. Which means this is the technique of meditation for this yuga. I think it's very, very clear. It is not that, as we said, it was not contextual. It was not based on the kind of people who are around Swami. It was not because certain section of devotees were reading Sanatan Sarathi and to them this had to be taught. This is the avatar saying that if you wish to take up the discipline of meditation, this is the best way to do it. In fact, when we were speaking to Mr. Hira from Japan, who is right now one of the trustees of the Central Trust, and a very senior devotee, very inspiring gentleman from Japan, a very, very successful businessman. I think he runs a chain of hotels, and apart from doing that, he's very active in the organization, and now he's having this added responsibility of being the trustee of the Central Trust. And
then recently there was some Veda.
Right, recently I think they've inaugurated, I don't know what exactly it is, there's an article on the website, more or less a report. The President of India was in Japan to inaugurate that event. It's more like a cultural institution which spreads awareness about Indian culture and Vedantic culture. And he had said that how Swami had inspired him to start that. And he's involved in so many things. And in the interview, Karuna Munshi Nidhi had asked him, he said, you're all doing so many activities simultaneously. What is the secret of your inspiration? How do you manage time, right? Because we know that business is not a 9-to-5 job, right? If you're employed somewhere, you can always find time for other interests. But when you're involved in this kind of business, it kind of takes away all your time and energy. How are you able to give time to other activities like this? And his simple, straight answer was, all my inspiration comes from Dhyanavahini. He says, I derive all my energy and all my ability to manage my time from doing Jyoti meditation. And he said, I do it every day, regularly, even now. And he very clearly, he explains what Swami says in Jyoti meditation and how it helps him in everyday life. And he said, any businessman who comes to me and says, I want to be successful in business, I tell them, go and practice Jyoti meditation, because it makes you very mindful. It makes you very aware of what you're doing, what you're speaking, what you're doing. I mean, what a beautiful endorsement. Of course, Swami's words need no endorsement, but our minds are in a level where we look around people who are successful and see if they are able to endorse Swami's words, right? So these are not really esoteric, and not that it cannot be applied in everyday life. There are people who have benefited from these words. And this Dhyanavahini Swami wrote in 1959, really, really long time ago.
You know, Prem, I just feel that we are all donkeys who cannot appreciate the value of sandalwood. It's almost like that, because, you see, generally in life, Swami gives the fragrance of jasmine, the fragrance of rose freely available. But we go and pay huge amounts of money to buy a perfume in which a little of that essence has been added, you know. It's almost like that. The number of life engineering, life re-engineering, you know, spirituality courses that have come out and are booming commercially in the world today, you know, with such selflessness this has been given. You can be assured that however well the other courses in the world are being marketed, they cannot be pure simply because there is a huge commercial angle. In fact, that is the basis. How everything else is sustained is from the course fees. And they are quite exorbitant fees. And we cough up all that and go readily there. But here is something that is being given free of charge. And like you said, what to do? We are such donkeys that we need kicks from people like Ryuko Hira sir, who is more successful. He's the richest Indian in Japan. He's one among the richest people in Japan. So it is not as if a failure is talking about it. Worldly wise, he has got all the success, and he credits his entire success to just one among the 26 Vahinis. And really, it just made me feel that I don't do Jyoti meditation at all. I want to do, and I don't know how long this inspiration will sustain, but possibly we become, you know, we become amenable to more such inspiration if we actually decide to put in some consistent effort in reading these Vahinis. I mean, if we can't put in that much consistent effort, it's actually shame on us, because look at the consistent effort that Swami put in. Once Dhyana Vahini got over, from March 1960 to February 1961, for 9 months he wrote the Prashanti Vahini. For 9 months following that, the Jnana Vahini. For 13 months following that, the Dharma Vahini. And for a year following that, Swami wrote the Upanishad Vahini. You know, the Upanishad Vahini was written from February 1963 to January 1964. We have to remember that in the July of 1963, Swami had that stroke for 7 days. And I think it was July 13th or July 14th, July 11th, when Swami actually sprinkled water on himself. I'm forgetting the exact date, but somewhere it was in the teenage only, you know, 11 to 15, July, when Swami sprinkled water on himself and, you know, got rid of the stroke. And that beautiful episode that Swami narrated, dating back to the times of sage Bharadwaja, and how Shiva had promised that this would happen. That was the historical reason. Of course, the immediate reason was Swami had taken over the stroke of a devotee. So for 8-9 days, what 8-9 days? I think for almost 10 to 11 days, Swami was physically incapacitated. And yet he wrote the Upanishad Vahini. You know, Upanishad, they say Upanishad, meaning you sit close to and below a learned one, so that just like water flows from a higher level to a lower level, knowledge flows from a higher level to a lower level. Swami was not just writing the Upanishad Vahini, his life was an Upanishad there. It was there for all to see. I mean, this kind of purity and perfection, I don't think we'll get anywhere, because even in the month of July 1963, Swami has written the Upanishad Vahini. It's simply amazing and thrilling to just think of it.
Right, absolutely. And these were probably the times when, you know, if you go into Satyam Shivam Sundaram, the early 60s, Swami was establishing the Balvikas program. Swami was formalizing the organization, the many local conferences which were held, I think, in Chennai. Swami had a few conferences in Rajahmundry. All of that was with this period. And some of those times when there's this beautiful publication by, I think, the Hostel Publication or the Books and Publications Trust, the Sri Satya Sai Digvijayam, where they have kind of followed Swami in, you know, in every day what the Swami timeline was, and where Swami was doing, the entire timeline. You would see that when Swami is traveling to some of these places in Rajahmundry, in and around, in fact, a good amount of work has been done by the Telugu team too, in trying to go to some of these places where Swami has been there, you would find that Swami has given 3 discourses in a day. Swami would start at 4 in the morning from one place, reach some place at 6 o'clock, give a discourse there, have breakfast, go to some other place, give a discourse there, have lunch, again start traveling, evening go to another place and give a discourse. And, I mean, that's how packed when Swami is traveling is. You know, when we say that Swami was traveling and still writing this, I think that's important to see that Swami was not, it was not a pleasure travel for Swami. Swami's travels were always packed. And as you said, it's so difficult to, you know, sit in an environment which is different from what we are used to and do creative work which you're used to doing. Right? If we can call that the work which we do as creative, or at least which requires an intense mental activity, like preparing for a talk or writing an article, it becomes very difficult if you have to do it sitting in a place which you are not used to, you know, somewhere else. Because that's how our mind works. It needs that. In fact, when Swami speaks about Dhyana Vahini and meditation and Dhyana Vahini, that's what he says. Fix a place, fix a time, fix a, you know, particular activity. Do it in your puja room. Because all of that helps in the mind concentrating. But very fact that Swami could sit anywhere, keep doing anything, could have ailments in his body and still keep writing all of this, it purely is a testimony to the fact that it was a Vahini from the source. It did not need the preparation of the mind for these great articles to be written.
Now, I haven't read all the Vahinis, but I'm sure that I heard from someone that this is from the Vahini itself, where Swami defines a true sannyasi. Mm-hmm. Among the 4 stages, Brahmacharya, Grihastha, Vanaprastha and Sannyasa, Swami says a sannyasi shouldn't spend a night or eat a meal in the same place for two times. And if we look at Swami's life during this period, it was almost like a sannyasa. Swami traveled so extensively and intensely. For instance, in the Satyam Shivam Sundaram part 2 I was reading, there is a period where I think Swami must have traveled through something like 300 to 400 villages in Karnataka in a span of something like 50 to 60 days. The same in the case of Andhra Pradesh. So you can be rest assured that not even wife a single day. I think every 6 hours he is in a different place with different people giving discourses. In fact, during that period, so many discourses we have lost actually, simply because humanly it was impossible for Professor Kasturi to capture everything. He has given 2 to 3 line summaries of what Swami spoke in each place. Here Swami spoke on the this of the Atma. Here Swami spoke on how you should do the Namasmarana. I mean, it's just a brief summary because, let's face it, if Swami is giving 4 discourses in a day, when you are traveling along with Swami, you are not the divine generator that Swami is. You are not able to keep up pace. So Swami has been a sannyasi all his life in that sense, without any attachment, absolutely detached. And yet, he has been so passionate, consistent and persistent with writing the Vahinis. I think that should be the greatest inspiration. After the Upanishad Vahini, from February 1964 to 1966, for 27 months, Swami wrote the Gita Vahini. And very interestingly, during that same period, from February 1964 to, not till 1966, but till May of 1965, for 15 months, Swami also wrote the Prashnottara Vahini. It's very interesting when we look at it and think of it as the Gita is Arjuna asking questions which are bothering him and Krishna giving the answers. And Prashnottara Vahini is nothing but the same kind of questions being asked from Swami and Swami giving answers for that. And it's so beautiful that when Swami is writing these Vahinis also, similar themes have been bunched together. What happened in the Dwapara Yuga versus what's happening in the Kali Yuga. So the Gita Vahini and Prashnottara Vahini were written simultaneously in the years between 1964 and 1966.
In fact, even before Swami, I think just after Swami concluded Prashnottara Vahini, Swami started off with the Bhagavata Vahini, even as Swami was writing the Gita Vahini. And interestingly, I mean, we've had the opportunity to go through Bhagavata Vahini as part of the afternoon satsang. And we've seen that it is actually quite different from the Srimad Bhagavatam, right? When you look at, when you say Bhagavatam, it is based on the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is supposed to have been penned by Vyasa, as narrated by Sukha Maharishi. But you can make out that it is different. And I think that is why it is also important to go through these texts, because Swami would say, what is relevant for this age? What the mind of this age can comprehend and can accept without getting confused? Right, Swami says that is what has been given in the form of this Bhagavata Vahini. And,
you know, speaking of Bhagavata Vahini, we had done that. We have done it in detail, going through each chapter, each page. But one thing that remains very firmly etched in my mind is how Swami would compare the Bhagavatam to the ocean. He would say that the ocean has waves. Each wave is possibly a leela, a mahima, a story or an anecdote in the Bhagavatam, in the ocean of the Bhagavatam. So when you start relating Swami's leela, Swami's stories, it is like someone sitting on the seashore and counting the waves. You can count the waves, yes. And you can come and say that in the last 3 hours that I sat, I have counted 5,000 waves. Yes, that is what you counted. That is not the beginning of the Bhagavatam. That is not the end of the Bhagavatam. Swami says the Bhagavata is like that. Endless are the waves. For you, the Bhagavatam begins and ends at a point, because that is where you decided to start counting the waves and that is where you decided to stop counting the waves. Otherwise, it's the infinite Bhagavatam which can go on for all times. In fact, there is that famous poem in Hindi. I think it's there even in Sanskrit. It's the original is in Sanskrit, which says that if you take all the mountains as your writing paper, if you take all the trees and make pens out of them, use all the water in the oceans as ink, even then, I mean, not there. And goddess Saraswati, the goddess of learning, the deity who epitomizes Vidya or education. Even if she starts writing the glories of God, with all these, she will not be able to complete it. That is how it is. And this kind of an analogy, I mean, it has just simply stuck in my mind that how much ever you try, it will never get complete. In fact, it came as a relief for me as well, you know, when we were doing the Bhagavata Vahini, because I always used to feel that being in Radio Sai or being Swami's student, being a person who loves Swami, we must capture all the incidents in Swami's life as possible. And, you know, when you hear of some elderly devotee passing away and you get to know few stories of that he or she had experienced, you know, you rue the fact that, oh God, we missed out that, we missed out this. After reading the Bhagavata Vahini, it came as a balm to my heart that you do your best to capture, but don't feel bad that you missed out, because even if you had not missed out that, it is never possible for you to capture the ocean. You can only count the waves. You can possibly keep awake for another hour and count another 1,000 waves. But don't think that you have measured the ocean with that. So it definitely gave me a lot more soothing peace of mind. It gave me a sense that all I need to do is put my best efforts and try to capture Swami's stories in whatever way possible. And the rest is left to him. So, you know, as you rightly said, the Bhagavata Vahini is the Bhagavatam and much more, because that we will realize only when we go through it. And I'm speaking so much because Bhagavata Vahini is possibly one among the three Vahinis that I have actually read.
And in fact, talking about the introductory part where Swami says this, you know, you can start and stop counting the waves, but you never can complete it. And similarly, Swami says about the purpose of an avatar. Hmm. And that Swami says in the Bhagavata Vahini, he says, people often say, imagine this is coming right after Gita Vahini. Because in the Gita, Krishna says that God comes for dharma samsthapana and for punishing the evil and fostering the good.
Hmm.
And in the Bhagavatam, in the introduction, Swami says, people often say that God comes for this purpose. Right? And Swami says that's not the case. God comes only to fulfill the yearning of the devotees. And then Swami gives that analogy. The cow produces milk only for the calf. There's so many other people that might benefit. But the cow did not come with the motive of giving milk to all those people. And then and cow does not stop or mind others benefiting also. So Swami says God comes down in a human form only so that he can bless the devotees who have yearned for his presence. Dharma samsthapana and, you know, punishing of the evil and fostering of the good happens as the side benefits of an avatar coming. So some of these revelations, and very beautifully, you know, if you look at it from the philosophical point of view, we've seen the context in which the Bhagavatam was written. When Vyasa writes the Mahabharata, he has finished categorizing all the Vedas. He has written the great scripture of Gita, Bhagavad Gita.
Mm.
And then he is not satisfied. He is having a, you know, dissatisfaction in his mind. He does not have peace. And that is when I think Narada who comes and guides him to write the Bhagavatam. So literally in that flow, Swami writes, you know, the Gita Vahini, the Prashnotara Vahini, which is like the modern day Gita.
Mm.
And that is followed by Bhagavat Vahini. Right? You know, even the listeners might, even the readers might feel that having read all these heavy verses of Upanishad Vahini, Jnana Vahini and everything, you know, we need something which is, you know, more soothing to the heart.
After the Bhagavata Vahini comes what is closest personally to my heart, and I think we both of us share this sentiment to a certain extent because we have gone through that Vahini for more than 3 years. I used to always, you know, boast, not in a boastful manner, but feel a kind of warm pride in my heart that all said and done, Prem and I have gone through the Ram Katha Rasa Vahini for 3 years. 3 years continuously, every week we have read through it and gone through. You know, that bubble got pricked and that balloon burst when I realized that Swami has spent 7.5 years penning down that Ram Katha Rasa Vahini. Right from February 1970 till August 1977. For 91 months, Swami has spent. And in front of that, you know, the 3 years that we put in suddenly feel so small. It's not even 50% of the time that Swami has put in for the Ram Katha Rasa Vahini. And Ram Katha Rasa Vahini, because personally, it has been a Vahini that we have gone through to great detail. So many inspiring aspects in that. And you know, one was shared on that day during the program, and one possibly I'll share now. One aspect that really inspired me is, again, it's related to the same super aspect of yearning and craving for God. Sita was one example, but there's another concept, the concept of the three zeros that we often hear about. The three zeros basically mean that it's easy to theoretically say that God is the one whom I yearn for most, but practically what does it mean? Practically, what when you say that God is the dearest to me, you should be able to give up the three zeros. What are the three zeros? The first zero is wealth. It is said that if you hold God as the dearest, then if you lose your wealth, you should not be bothered. Because in the true sense, from the perspective of the soul, from the perspective of the Atma, worldly wealth is nothing but a big zero. It can come and go anytime. That's why Adi Shankara says, Ma Kuru Dhana Jana Yauvana Garvam Harati Nimeshat Kala Sarvam. In 1 minute, it can be taken away. So that is the first zero. And the second zero is supposed to be our relationships, our friendships, people. People whom we consider our own, our attachments. From the perspective, from the highest perspective of the Atma, all this is nothing but zero. It comes to naught. It doesn't matter at all. And the final zero, the toughest zero, is supposed to be that of your own self-concept. We have a concept of ourselves. I am Arvind. I am a speaker. I am a person who loves Swami. I am Swami's student. I am a father to a child. You know, so many identities that we tie. And we are very attached to these identities. That's why we put in efforts to ensure that these identities live on even after we are physically dead. We put in all efforts to ensure that. But that also I should be ready to give up if I genuinely feel that Swami is what I want the most in life. And in the Ramkatha Rasavahini, we get to see examples for all three. I would not say that one sacrifices one and doesn't sacrifice the other, but it's very evident that Sita is a person who gives up the first zero very easily, all the great wealth. She says, I don't want. Rama, if you are not in Ayodhya, Ayodhya is not Ayodhya. Ayodhya is a forest for me. If you are there in the forest becomes Ayodhya for me. With all, it becomes the most comfortable place. So she gives up, being a princess, a dainty princess, she gives up all the luxuries. And then if you look at the second zero, I feel Lakshmana is an example of that. Lakshmana is not a bachelor. He is married to Urmila. In that sense, as Swami beautifully portrays, I don't think anybody else has given so much importance to Urmila as Swami has done. Even Urmila is an exemplar for giving up the second zero. Because she also parts with her husband. For 14 years, Lakshmana and Urmila live away from each other. Both because of their love for Rama. Lakshmana goes with Rama because he loves Rama. Urmila allows Lakshmana to go with Rama because she loves Rama. They both give up this relationship, which is, you know, in the worldly sense, one of the closest, most intimate relationships is supposed to be between a husband and a wife. And they give up that for Rama. And for the third, we have the example of Mother Kaikeyi, whom Swami has actually resurrected in a sense in his discourses in the later years, where he says that Rama himself goes to Kaikeyi and says, Mother, I have not come here to simply rule Ayodhya. I have a mission that is waiting. So many people I have to bless, and also I have to kill Ravana. So therefore, you have to cooperate with me and you have to do this if you love me. And Kaikeyi says, I love you, I will do it. And Rama says that, Mother, if you do this, you will get a bad name. You know, everybody will curse you. Nobody will take up the name Kaikeyi also. But she says, Rama, I don't bother about it. If this is what you want, if this is what will make you happy, I'm ready to do that for you. She is an exemplar for the one who gave up the third zero. She gave up her own self-respect, her self-esteem, her fair name. I think for yugas, Kaikeyi has been reviled and criticized till this Kali Yuga, where Swami, you know, I think it's so beautiful the way Lord also, you know, pays back gratitude. He has paid homage to Kaikeyi. And so we get to see all these. The one who sacrificed the first zero, Sita, the second zero, Lakshmana and Urmila, the third zero, Kaikeyi. Very, very inspiring. So many more inspirations. But I think the Ram Katha shows us how we should lead our life. More importantly, how we should yearn for God.
And, I mean, talking about the Ramkatha, as you said, we've gone through it for 3 years, nothing much left to say about it. But one thing which we have to point out and say what was very inspiring is, one thing which Swami says throughout the Ramayana, through these various characters, is even if you have devotion, you will have to purify your mind. You know, those are two tasks that you have to take up separately. Mm-hmm. Hmm. And Swami says that when, you know, in that dialogue between Rama and Mother Sita before they, Mother Sita gets abducted. And he says there, you know, this is the nature of Ravana. And a very beautiful line where Swami writes, Rama says that we have to hold up Ravana as an example to the world. That you could be a great devotee, but if you have not purified your heart, your task is not complete. So he says, here is a great devotee, he is a great devotee of Lord Shiva, but he has not purified his mind of, you know, kama and all these other flaws. And we have to tell him that God does not accept a heart which has not been purified. And that is one point he says. The other character which is dual in nature in that sense is that of Vali. Swami writes beautifully when Vali is dying at the laps of Rama. He asks this question, why did you do this to me and why did you shoot me from behind? In fact, Swami writes that Vali says, had you come and told me that you want to kill me, I would have come in front of you. Mm. Right? And kind of really changes your idea of who Vali is. And Swami writes, at one point Rama says, you know, I'm so pleased with you, I will revive you, I will ensure that you don't die. And then Vali says, Rama, I'm not such a fool. You know, he says that my anger clouded my wisdom, but I'm not such a fool. Mm. He says, I'm having now an opportunity which even your father did not have, of dying looking at your face, and I will not trade this for anything. Right? So again, this the idea that here is one who has such deep love and wisdom within, but just that anger and just that greed and whatever, that moment, that emotion clouds that wisdom. So that idea, and the other beautiful thing about the Ramakatha Rasavahini, as we have gone through, as we also made a reference to, Swami wrote this for 7 years, but still Swami did not complete everything that he wanted to say about the Ramayana. As we went through the Ramakatha Rasavahini, we quoted extensively from Swami's other discourses. The 1996 Samukos discourse, completely on the Ramayana, where many of the things which Swami has not mentioned in the Ramakatha Rasavahini were mentioned there. I think in 2000 or 2001, again the Samukos, where Swami spoke about Ramayana. So in that sense, looking at the Vahinis themselves and the discourses, there are many things which Swami has said in a very crisp and cryptic manner in the Vahinis, which in the discourses Swami elaborated upon, with probably an example, with Chinnakathas, with making references to devotees who were there. You know, suddenly Swami would take an example of a devotee who was seated there, or a devotee who had visited Swami, and or something which Swami saw during the travels. But all of this were essentially the same concepts which Swami spoke about in the Vahinis in a very crisp and focused manner.
Very true what you say about the crisp and, in quotes, cryptic manner as well, because this Kaikeyi's redemption surprisingly doesn't figure in the Ramakatha Rasavahini.
Right.
And yet hints about Kaikeyi's nature is embedded, because, you know, when I read the Ramakatha Rasavahini, it felt unbelievable that a lady who so vehemently asks for Rama to be banished and her son to be crowned in his place, the very next day, she is in the head of the procession, falling on her knees and begging Rama to come back. And Rama says, Mother, you should not fall. I should fall at your feet. It's just not possible. But I think therein, Swami has put in the seed to show the true nature of Kaikeyi. Swami describes in great detail the conversation between Kaikeyi and Rama. And when you read that, you definitely get a feeling that Kaikeyi is not a bad woman. And also, you know, even before this thing actually happens, Swami has mentioned in 2-3 places of how Kaikeyi has great love for Rama. In fact, Kaikeyi loves Rama more than Kausalya loves Rama, Swami says. So having built up such a character of Kaikeyi, it definitely causes a suspicion or a doubt in any intelligent reader's mind as to how can such a Kaikeyi, overnight, because of a few words of a maid servant, change her whole thing and become angry. No, it is not like that. So, cryptically Swami has placed it, and I think for us, for a few of us duds who were not able to get it, Swami later on in his discourses elaborated in detail. I think in a couple of discourses Swami has elaborated in great detail as to how Rama goes and requests Kaikeyi, saying that please do this for me, Mother. Please use those two boons that you have now. It is not enough if you make only Bharata the emperor, because then I will still be stuck over here. I have to travel the length and breadth of this country, and then I have to end up in Lanka, and then I have to come back. So it is not enough if Bharata becomes king alone. Bharata should become king and I should be banished away. So as you rightly said, some of these are cryptically and placed in the Vahinis, but that is also the thrill and beauty, right? When you discover something, like a child, you know, you get that excitement. Spoon feeding is one thing, but when you learn to decipher something, that joy is totally different and at a higher level, at a higher, much grander scale. And Swami has given us the opportunity to do that as well. Each time we read a Vahini, each time we read a page, the same thing seems to, you know, blossom some other understanding within us, and the joy of discovery is so immense. We should really be grateful to Swami for having kept that also as well for us, so that we get the joy of discovery.
And that was about the Ramakatha Rasavahini, which Swami wrote for nearly 7 years. And then Swami started what was Bharatiya Paramartha Vahini. And if you look for the book, you will not find this book with this title, Bharatiya Paramartha Vahini, because it was merged in the other Vahini that Swami wrote subsequently, which was the Satyasai Vahini. Hmm. So the Bharatiya Paramartha Vahini and what Swami wrote later for 37 months from 1978 January to 1981 February was merged into the Satyasai Vahini. And the Satyasai Vahini, I think, it's a very, very comprehensive book about the various things that Swami has to convey about discipline, about devotion, about how one has to lead life in a family. And it's a assortment of various kind of explanations and beautiful, you know, about unity of faiths, which probably does not appear as much in all the other Vahinis. Swami speaks a lot in Satyasai Vahini. So in that sense, Satyasai Vahini is whatever Swami wanted to convey for the modern day time, which is all compiled together. And as you can see, it was written for so many years. I think 4 years Swami took to write the Bharatiya Paramartha Vahini and Satyasai Vahini.
Though I have not read it completely, I just feel that is possibly the reason why a lot about Bharatiya culture also gets into Satyasai right. Vahini, because the first 15 months were about the Bharatiya Paramartha Vahini. Combining them both, it becomes the third biggest Vahini, because Swami has written it for, I think, 37 plus 15, which is about 42 months. 52 months.
Months, right.
So the biggest is the Ramakatha Rasa Vahini, the second is the Bhagavata Vahini, and the third is the Satyasai Vahini, which is a combination of Bharatiya Paramartha Vahini and Satyasai Vahini. And from 1981 till September 1982, for 18 months, Swami writes the Vidya Vahini. Again, so beautifully, it is coinciding with the starting of the university. The deemed university, the ad block came into existence. So, it's again very, very significant that as the institute of higher learning starts, Swami writes a Vahini which presents to us what actually higher learning is. Because higher learning doesn't mean age. Higher, Swami says, is the Atma Vidya. And therefore, beautifully, Swami pens the Vidya Vahini.
Right. And We also know that there is a program which Swami started, the Satyasai Vidya Vahini. In fact, Brother Satyajit, who was one of the initiators of that movement, you know, he was saying that when he was discussing the concept with Swami, and he said, Swami, we want to do like this, we want to train teachers. And I think they prepared a document and they showed it to Swami, Shri Satyasai Vidya Vahini. And Swami looked at it and Swami read everything, and very, very sweetly Swami said, do you know that I have also written a book on this? In the same name, Vidya Vahini, there's one book also. He said, Swami, that is the inspiration. That's why we named it Vidya Vahini. Right? And probably the only other time when Swami made a reference to a book that Swami has written himself. But again, it's a very crisp book. The Vidya Vahini is compared to something like the Satyasai Vahini or Ramakatha Rasa Vahini. But in a very crisp manner, Swami speaks about the philosophy of education. And it's very beautiful, you know. On one hand, Swami was writing probably the vision document of what education should be all about. On the other hand, Swami was establishing a modern university, which was recognized by the government, by, you know, accepted by all normal standards as a regular university. Of course, the colleges were there already, but this gave Swami much, much more control over, you know, how that institution could be run. And what a beautiful completion to all of that. When finally the NAC committee comes and says that this is the example, that
this is the crest jewel,
and this is an example which all other universities have to follow. Because it's so beautiful when you think of it. Swami gave it in writing, you know, what education should be. But Swami also had simultaneously established a model university by saying that, you know, this is how it has to be run and this is how it can be done. Don't think of this as something which is very idealistic and cannot be practically achieved.
After the Vidyavahini, from October 1982 to February 1984, for 16 months, Swami wrote the Sutravahini, and again from March 1984 to October 1984, for just 8 months, a very small one, possibly this is the smallest among all the Vahinis, the Leela Kaivalya Vahini. So, just for our listeners, quickly to go through, Prema Vahini, Sandeha Nivarini, Dhyana Vahini, Prashanti Vahini, Jnana Vahini, Dharma Vahini, Upanishad Vahini, Gita Vahini, Prashnotra Vahini, Bhagavata Vahini, Ramkatarasa Vahini, Bharatiya Paramartha Vahini and Satyasai Vahini, which got combined to Satyasai Vahini, Vidya Vahini, Sutra Vahini and Leela Kaivalya Vahini. So, after combining Bharatiya Paramartha Vahini and Satyasai Vahinis, these figure to be the 15 Vahinis that Swami has gifted us. If we separate them, it becomes the 16 Vahinis. The number 16 is very, very significant. It is said to be the Kalas, the number of Kalas that a Purnavatar possesses. It's like the Purnavatar has 16 Kalas, and those 16 Kalas have expressed themselves as 16 Vahinis.
Right. And there were many things that we wanted to say on that day, and in fact, that's one of the reasons we started the afternoon satsang on this. But we might not be able to cover even after two afternoon satsangs, because honestly, if one Vahini Swami wrote for 7 years, you can understand 26 years of, we are not qualified enough to speak on all the Vahinis, and we do not probably have the time to speak of whatever little we are qualified enough to speak about also. So that shows an extent of what Swami has written.
And Prem, I don't think our endeavor anytime was to be comprehensive. Dear listener, this was an effort just to instigate in everyone, including us both here, the interest and inspiration to go and read the Vahinis more and more. I personally have definitely felt inspired. I have started the Dharma Vahini, and hopeful, most probably I'll be even starting the Dhyana Vahini. I mean, Prem has read many more compared to me. So that was the idea why we thought of doing this, because this is a gift, as we said in the beginning of the satsang, a gift that Swami spontaneously gave all of us without us asking. So therefore, going by the logic of what Swami has said in the discourses, Adugakave O Manasa, don't ask, O mind, because when you don't ask, unasked, you will be given the greatest gift. So going by that shloka, the Vahinis must be the greatest gift, and we should not waste it. And in order to inspire our own selves and everybody else as well, we did this satsang for 2 weeks as a follow-up to our program in the Mandir. We do hope that you have been inspired, and if you have got any of your Vahini stories to share, your inspirations as well as how, you know, you've had experiences relating to the Vahini, you can definitely write to us. If not next week, once we gather enough material, we'll possibly do another Vahini satsang on how the Vahinis have touched many lives, because we are sure it has touched many, many lives, and we just hope that we are able to take a dip in this Vahini and get our lives touched as well. On that note, dear listeners, we will bring this satsang to a close. We will end with a song, on the other side of which you will be greeted as always by Brother Chandu in his segment, Love to Love.
Janani ma, janani ma sai janani ma
janani ma sai janani ma
prem vahini ma gyan
ಪ್ರಶಾಂತಿ ವಾಹಿನಿ ಚಿರ ಸುಖದಾಯಿನಿ
ಪ್ರಶಾಂತಿ ವಾಹಿನಿ ಚಿರ ಸುಖದಾಯಿನಿ
ಜಯ ಜಯ ಸಾಯಿ
ಸಾಯಿ ಜನನಿ ಮಾ.